The mysteries of the universe are mysteries for a reason. They are hard. They make our brains hurt. And you know what? I'll say it. Reality TV is just way more accessible. On this episode of the Oxford Sparks Big Questions podcast, we are becoming particle physics experts, and we are asking, what is antimatter? Hello, I'm Emily Elias, and this is the show where we seek out the brightest minds at the University of Oxford. We make them weigh in on those tricky questions that help us understand the entire freaking universe. Here to hold our hands and make sure that we don't get lost in a field of science that puzzles literal geniuses is Donal Hill. He is a postdoc at the Oxford LHCb Particle Physics Group. And what do you spend your day doing?
Most of the time I'm a code monkey. So I spend a lot of time writing code, debugging code, worrying about statistics, worrying about how many events are there in this little peak or bump, and then also trying to get other people to answer my emails.
Particle physicists, they're just like us. Okay, now before we get into the deep end of what is antimatter, let's start at the beginning, matter.
So when a physicist talks about matter, what they mean are the particles that make up all of the things that we see around us, all the different atoms. And you can build the periodic table from basically three things, electrons, protons, and neutrons. But antimatter is a different beast entirely. It's sort of nature's mirror of normal stuff, kind of the yin to its yang. And in a very real sense, it's the opposite of everything we're familiar with. And I'm employed to actually study it, so there must be something behind it.
Scientists started to suspect antimatter existed in the late 1920s. In the height of the jazz era, a young scientist from Bristol named Paul Dirac was not at any underground clubs. No, he was instead partying with his equations.
Dirac was brought up bilingual, actually, but ended up not really speaking French or English. He was very, very shy and tended to just speak in equations. And Dirac in Cambridge in sort of 1928 was worrying about how to combine Einstein's ideas of special relativity, which is what happens when things move very close to the speed of light, with the ideas of quantum physics, or the fuzzy uncertainties of quantum mechanics and the behavior of tiny particles like electrons. So the problem he was worried about was how to describe an electron that's moving very close to the speed of light. And at the time, it bugged a lot of physicists that you got two answers when you tried to figure out how much energy does that electron have. You got a plus number and you got a minus number. And the plus number was the easy one. That's just the electron. It has positive energy. But negative energy doesn't really make any sense. There is no such thing, as far as we can tell, in the world around us. So most physicists just dismissed it. They said, that's a meaningless solution. But because of Dirac's real respect for mathematics, he was led by the equations. He didn't really feel comfortable throwing away one of the answers.
A then 26-year-old Dirac goes back to his equations, and he has a spark of genius. He decided to take that negative number and make it something physical, something real. And even though there's zero experimental evidence for this, he asks, what if there is a hypothetical particle that behaves in the opposite of an electron? What if we are dealing with a Jekyll and Hyde situation in physics?
What he'd done was just predict the existence of the positron in 1928, and he was basically uniformly mocked. No one bought it. So when he gave talks in conferences and seminars, people would raise their hand and taunt him afterwards and say, well, where is this anti-electron that you talk about? And he didn't really have the answer at the time. But it turned out, well, once people cottoned on to his ideas, they started to look carefully at some photographs of cosmic ray interactions that they'd taken 5 years earlier, so in 1923. And when they revisited these images, they started noticing weird little tracks that curved the wrong way. And by 1932, they realized that these little tracks were actually the signature of positrons. So all the while, these little antimatter electrons had been leaving their mark in photographs, but just nobody knew what they were until Dirac actually came up with his prediction.
Donald says what's amazing is that with just a few equations written on a piece of paper, Dirac predicts an entire class of matter called antimatter. There are these photographs of cosmic rays that prove he's right, and by the age of 31, Dirac wins a Nobel Prize.
And not long after the positron was found in the lab, all of these other antimatter particles started to crop up, and slowly but surely we realized that all of the normal matter particles of our universe had these sort of evil twins. And then the mystery sort of emerged, well, where did all of that stuff go? Why doesn't the universe have antiparticles in it as well as particles? Why are we just made of stuff? And anti-stuff only gets produced in these high-energy collisions and radioactive decays. So that was the next sort of mystery.
So let's put on our imagination hats and go back to the start of the universe. Imagine there are two armies. One is called matter, the other is called antimatter. And on the surface, these two armies look pretty equally matched. They behave the exact same way. But on the day of the big cinematic battle, something goes wrong for the antimatter army.
We call this sort of event the Great Annihilation. So at the beginning of the universe, there was this sort of cosmic battle between stuff and anti-stuff. You have two sides that on the face of it should be completely equally matched and should lead to what they used to call mutually assured destruction in the Cold War. So there should have been sort of nothing left. Every matter particle should have destroyed its antimatter twin and leave zero. But if they'd left zero, we wouldn't be here. And somehow, matter was able to outlive antimatter by a tiny fraction. So that for every billion particles that annihilated each other, there was one matter particle that was able to survive. And that's enough stuff left over to make all of the stars and planets and people and coffee cups that we know and love today. And we still don't know why matter was able to win that battle. So that's what I work on at CERN.
In order for Donald to study antimatter, he's got to make antimatter. This is something that existed for a fraction of a second at the start of the universe. It is not exactly something you pick up at Tesco, which means he heads off to Switzerland to run experiments in the world's largest particle physics laboratory.
We have this beautiful machine 100 meters underground, this 27-kilometer circle line. If you've ever been on the Circle Line in London, it's about the same size. The tunnel's the same size. And inside that tunnel, we have the Large Hadron Collider, which is a set of accelerator units and magnets to speed a beam of protons around in a circle. And every time the protons come around, you give them another little kick of energy. And they get speeded up to such an extent that they travel around this 27-kilometer loop 11,000 times every second. So they're traveling at really, really close, within a fraction of a percent of the speed of light. So you've got one beam going that way, and then another beam of protons going around in the opposite direction. And at a few points around the ring, we cross them over each other. And we bash these protons together, head to head. So it's a very destructive exercise. But it turns out that destructiveness is actually very creative in the end, because we're, by destroying the protons and packing all that energy into a small space, we have enough energy density in this tiny little space to create huge numbers of very heavy, exotic particles.
CERN is replicating basically what happened at the start of the universe. I made Donald send me a voice message from his last trip from a spot that he usually watches his experiments.
So I'm here at CERN on what turns out to be the final day of high-energy proton collisions at the LHC this year. And it's pretty hard to tell from where I'm sitting here in Restaurant 1, actually. The only hint that big things are happening 100 meters underground are these status screens visible just above the water dispensers on my right.
While Donald sits in a restaurant and looks at a monitor that makes Super Nintendo graphics look advanced, particles take a run through the CERN gauntlet. And then the real work begins, combing through all the data.
But we don't just take data for a split second. We actually photograph these collision events with our detectors. Our detectors are basically huge digital cameras. and we take photographs millions of times every second. And then the job is to try and sieve your way through this data to keep the interesting stuff. So the vast majority of these millions of photographs are kind of uninteresting. Nothing happened. Very often the protons don't even hit each other because they're so small, it's actually very hard to get them to hit. So we store all this data, and then it's a very slow process to analyze it. And it's sort of a needle in a haystack procedure.
If you are able to mass produce and store antimatter, there are some sci-fi predictions of what could be done with it. Star Trek fans will know that antimatter batteries are what help power the Enterprise. And in the book Angels and Demons by author Dan Brown, a plot point is based around an antimatter dirty bomb. Donal says in real life, these things won't happen.
So antimatter, when it was discovered, nobody could have imagined that we could actually use it for anything really useful. But it turns out that you can. So in hospitals, for example, antimatter is routinely used in a scanning technique called positron emission tomography, or PET for short. So you can see the P stands for positron. So we're using antimatter to actually help us detect where cancer cells are in the body. And this is used in treatment planning for surgeries. You can use PET to really try and narrow down where the tissue is that needs to be dealt with. And nobody in 1928, when Dirac decided not to throw away that other solution to the equation, he wasn't thinking, definitely we can help treat cancer with this.
And similar to Dirac, Donald doesn't really know how exactly his work could be used in the future, but he does know that it's all a part of a bigger puzzle that physicists are slowly building upon as they try to unlock the riddle of the universe. This podcast was brought to you by Oxford Sparks from the University of Oxford, with music by John Lyons and the U.S. Army Blues. Special thanks to Donal Hill. Please tell us what you think about this podcast. Go and give us a rating on iTunes. It really helps other people find us. Or you can go to Twitter and tweet about us at Oxford Sparks. You can find us on Facebook and tell everybody how much you love us so much. And of course, we have a website, oxfordsparks.ox.ac.uk. I'm Emily Elias. Bye for now.